Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. On this week's program, I'd like to discuss the whys and the wherefores behind the current cultural, political war in our nation today. If you haven't noticed, there's a major conflict between conservative, traditional Christian moral values versus LGBTQ, wokeism, statism, cultural Marxism, and the racism of DEI. There's basically two religions, two worldviews in conflict. Now, social intellectuals will often explain the conflict as the difference between social economic needs, the different needs between the young and the old, or the people in the country versus the people in the city, superstition versus science. But these are excuses or smoke screens to hide the real issue. Just, you know, this last week I watched a YouTube where the YouTuber tried to explain why intellectuals, leftist intellectuals, are such idiots. And as an example, he used Malcolm Caldwell, a Marxist professor at the University of London, who admired and visited the communist leader in Cambodia, Pol Pot. And he said some things that Pol Pot didn't like, and Pol Pot took him out and shot him. You know, such is the naivety of the left. Another example he used was Robert McNamara, the CEO of Ford, who Kennedy appointed as Secretary of Defense. McNamara thought that he could win the Vietnam War with all of his statistical analysis, but he only made matters worse because McNamara didn't understand human nature. Another example was the Stanford professor Paul Ehrlich, who in 1968 wrote the bestseller The Population Bomb, predicting that by 1980, the world would run out of food and all marine life would die because of overpopulation. And this YouTuber, his explanation for the idiocy of these leftist intellectuals was that they created models for the world and refused to be corrected by other data. So for many, the key to understanding the culture war today is that it's a knowledge problem, an intellectual problem. Remember the conservative commentator, Michael Savage? He used to always say that liberalism is a mental disorder. And this is also what Plato wrote about in his Republic, that bad rulers suffer from a lack of knowledge. So therefore, he concluded that countries need philosopher kings. Well, certainly, a lack of knowledge is part of leftism. Even the biblical prophet Hosea said, "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge." But a lack of knowledge is only the result of a deeper cause. Hosea was just mentioning one of the superficial secondary causes. The Bible itself peels back the onion even further because there is a deeper reason why certain people reject certain knowledge, or rather, they are selective concerning the data that they want to acknowledge. Well, in short, it's a matter of moral choice. Our neighbors, our coworkers, our family aren't turning to Christ, not because of a lack of knowledge. It's a moral choice of the will. They're at enmity with God, and as the scriptures teach, they're corrupt in their very nature. True knowledge is suppressed because of an evil nature, Romans chapter 1, verse 18. And unless by the power of the Spirit of God, they turn to God, they will continue to remain in darkness. 2 Corinthians 3:16, whenever a man turns to the Lord, the veil that's covering his eyes is taken away. Now, my great concern is that the Christian community may get lost in all of the minutia, even arguing and defending the peripherals rather than getting to the heart of the matter. Getting to the root is really essential for our personal evangelism and discipleship. The adversary would want nothing more than to sidetrack us from the real issue and get us arguing with unbelievers over tariffs or immigration or national debt. We need to be laying the axe to the root of the tree. And besides, if we don't properly diagnose the disease, we're not going to prescribe the right cure. So the Bible describes the problem as a moral problem. But the way the Bible most describes the situation is as a moral rejection of the law of God, which of course is rooted in a rejection of God's authority, but still the scripture emphasizes that the issue is a rejection of God's law, God's authority. And this is a truth that is completely neglected in current commentary on our culture, but it's a point that we need to be shouting from the rooftops. The problem in our nation is that the people have rejected and violated the law of God. The people have morally broken the law of God, just as Moses represented this physically by smashing the Ten Commandments. And if you hang in with me for a few minutes here, I trust you'll see the biblical case for this point. Let's start off with the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah asked God a question. Why is the nation collapsing morally, socially, economically, militarily? Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 12. Who is the wise man that may understand this? And who is he to whom the mouth of the Lord has spoken that he may declare it? Why is the land ruined, laid waste like a desert, so that no one passes through? The Lord said, because they have forsaken my law, which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, nor walked according to it. And this indictment is repeated constantly throughout the scriptures. Psalm 119, 126, it's time for the Lord to act, for they have broken your law. Psalm 119, 53, burning indignation has seized me because of the wicked who forsake your law. Did you ever feel that way reading in the news? Well, that's not Pharisaism, but that's godly, righteous indignation. Daniel chapter 9, verse 11. Indeed, all Israel has transgressed your law and has turned aside, not obeying your voice. Hosea chapter 8, verse 1. They have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. Amos chapter 2, verse 4. They have rejected the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes. Their lies also have led them astray. Zephaniah 3, they have done violence to my law. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 4, therefore the law is ignored, and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. Isaiah 24, 5, the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated statutes. Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 9, behold, they have rejected the word of the Lord. And what kind of wisdom do they have? Then there's the classic prophecy that describes the world's rebellion against God. Psalm chapter 2. The kings of the earth, they take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away their cords from us. That is a desire to be free from the restraint of God's law, his authority. The unsaved world is fighting against the law of God. Yet the law of God is the standard by which every person will be judged. Romans chapter 2, verse 12, all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. And the entire condemnation of Israel and the Gentile nations was based on the violating of God's moral standards, as expressed in what's called the law of God. Now, you might say, well, of course, you know, this is kind of obvious. People aren't following the law of God. That's not telling us anything new. Yet it really does. Because, like the prophets, the message we need to be communicating is that current day policies, current day ideas and behaviors are a violation of God's law. God's law is actually something that's real and must be followed. And that's completely outside the scope of people slinking today. What we're up against is the principle espoused by Satanism in the Church of Satan, where the law is do what thou wilt. Right and wrong are merely a function of human desire and utility. Everyone thinks in terms of self-affirmation, not the law of God. And this is what must be changed in our nation. You know, just like in ancient Israel. The people were dead set on doing what they wanted to do, and they ignored God's law. People are not submissively living under the authority of God. That's just not their mindset or their attitude. So what's this big deal about the law of God? What is it, and why is it so important? Well, theologically speaking, the law of God is the perfect representation of the character of God. The law is God himself. It's the expression of God's will, his person, and his character. You can check this out in any systematic theology textbook. The law is the expression of God's moral nature, and God's holiness is the fundamental attribute of his nature. The law is not a thing, it's God himself. It doesn't exist apart from his person. And the law is not made. The law is eternal like God. Men do not make the law. They discover the law. Just as a chemist or a physicist doesn't make natural law, they discover natural law. And regardless of one's opinion of those laws, or regardless of one's awareness of those laws, if one doesn't obey the laws of physics, he will be crushed. So also with God's moral law. God's law is not lessened one iota by man's inability to perceive it or to obey it. And as scientists are diligent to discover the details of natural law so they can stay alive, how much more should men be dedicated to discovering the details of God's moral law? And the law of God is not arbitrary. In other words, it's not as if God just makes up laws for the sake of discipline. Like a sergeant in boot camp may make a recruit scrub a floor with a toothbrush just to teach the recruit some obedience and some discipline. But God's law is not arbitrary in that way. His law is the revelation of his very holy nature. And furthermore, God's law is not temporary or local. It's not as if in some other age or in some other universe, adultery or homosexuality would be okay. God's eternal, God's unchanging, so his law is unchanging. And furthermore, nobody is an exception to God's law. You know, as trains are made to ride on tracks, we've been made to run on the track of God's law. God's law is the best and the perfect way for man to live. And the people of the nations must begin to think in terms of God's law. That should be the passion of every soul. Psalm 119:97. Oh, how I love your law. It's my meditation all the day. Psalm 119:127. Therefore, I love your commandments above gold. Yes, above fine gold. Psalm 119:163. I hate and despise falsehood, but I love your law. Psalm 119:165. My soul keeps your testimonies. I love them exceedingly. And also Psalm 1. How blessed is the man who delights in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. Deuteronomy 11:22. Be careful to keep all this commandment, which I'm commanding you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all of his ways, to hold fast to him. Deuteronomy 30:20, because this is your life. So that's the importance of the law of God. But what really is the law of God? Well, it certainly does include the Ten Commandments. The state of Texas just passed a law requiring a copy of the Ten Commandments to hang in every public school classroom. The state of Texas is challenging the Supreme Court on this. It's really quite unbelievable that our courts have actually outlawed the posting of the Ten Commandments in classrooms. The excuse is finding separation of church and state in the Constitution, but the real motive is a disbelief and an animus toward God. But nevertheless, the posting of the Ten Commandments is a good place to start, and is what we need in our country, that our young people would at least be made aware that there is a higher law of God to which we must submit. There are many other laws beside the Ten Commandments, such as all the principles laid down in the first three or four chapters of Genesis. And these laws have all been put on the conscience of every man. But in case there's any doubt, in 1445, God reinforced the law by putting it on tablets of stone for everyone to see. And of course, we must realize that the law of God is not just external, it's internal. The law of God must be obeyed with the right heart attitude. But what about the New Testament and the law of God? There is a great misunderstanding concerning the law of God in modern evangelicalism. In some places, it's despised or considered abrogated. There are some evangelicals with an almost antinomian, anti-law attitude, where the New Testament message of freedom from the penalty of the law has come to mean freedom from having to keep the law, using liberty as an occasion for the flesh. That since Christ's obedience and sufferings have satisfied the demands of the law, therefore the Christian is free from any obligation to observe the law. So we have to cover this error. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus specifically made the point that he did not come to abolish the law, but to establish the law. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth passes away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished." In both words, fulfilled and accomplished, the point is that the law needs to be established or come into existence. We need to accomplish the law. And if there's any doubt, Jesus then goes on to explain that anyone who tries to set aside the law of God will be judged. Verse 19, "Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." You want to be great in God's kingdom? Love and defend the law of God. And in verse 20, Jesus goes on to say that one's allegiance to the law needs to even be greater than that of the scribes and the Pharisees. Verse 20, "I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." And what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 is the point Paul makes in the book of Romans, that Christ died on the cross to take away our sins and to give us a new birth so that we can now fulfill the works of the law, not that we're free from keeping the law. Romans chapter 8, verse 3, "For what the law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending his own son in the likeness of sinful flesh as an offering for sin. He condemned sin in the flesh so that the requirements of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit." We're not saved from the holiness of God, but saved unto the holiness of God. We're saved to reflect the law of God and God's holy character. And there's also the promise of the new covenant, the new birth, that the law would not just be on tablets of stone, as in the old covenant, but now the law would be on our hearts, so that we would naturally desire to do the law. So Paul will write in Romans chapter 7, verse 12, "So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and righteous and good." In 1 Timothy 1, 8, "But we know that the law is good, that is, if one uses it lawfully." That is, as long as we don't use our own law-keeping as a means to earn heaven, but simply as part of our service and love for God. In the book of Galatians, the law is described as our tutor to lead us to Christ. The law shows us our failure and our need for Christ's salvation. But after the law leads us to Christ, we become a people that love to live by the law because it's our very nature. Another common mistake is that some Christians imagine that Christ replaced the law of God with the law of love. John chapter 13, verse 34, Jesus said, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another." But Jesus there was not abrogating or replacing the former commandments. He was simply adding one more. Call it an 11th commandment, if you will. And it's a commandment that's really behind all the other 10 commandments. Because if you love, you will actually keep the Ten Commandments. Unless anyone think that the law of God, the holy standards of God, are to be replaced, you know, with standards of our own feelings, of love and affection. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus also addressed this deception concerning those who say, "Lord, Lord, haven't we prophesied in your name? And in your name we've cast out demons, and in your name we've done many wonderful works." And Jesus says that he will say to them in that day, "Depart from me." And here is his key addition: "You who work lawlessness." 1 Corinthians 9:21, Paul clearly says he is not without law, but under the law of Christ, and that's the whole moral law of God. You know, the condemnation upon America and the entire world is that the people in the last days are being condemned for the violation of God's law. Matthew chapter 13, verse 41, "The Son of Man will send forth his angels and will gather out of his kingdom all stumbling blocks and those who commit lawlessness." 1 Timothy 1:9, "Those who are lawless and rebellious, the ungodly and sinners." Matthew 23:28, "Inwardly you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Matthew 24:12, "Because lawlessness has increased, most people's love will grow cold." 2 Corinthians 6:14, "What partnership has righteousness with lawlessness?" 2 Thessalonians 2:3, "The man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, will be revealed, the son of destruction." Hebrews 1:9, "You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness." 1 John 3:4, "Everyone who practices sin also practices lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness." There's the issue. There's the problem. The violation of God's law. Some recent stories. Over this last week, Colorado passed a law making it illegal to misgender someone by calling a transgender by their biological gender. This is their reaction to the Trump administration's pushback on the lie of transgenderism. And this is their lawlessness. Also, a 17-year-old male student at a high school in Minnesota is on the girls' softball team, and he's dominating other teams. All it took for him to play on the girls' sports team was for his mother to change his birth certificate from male to female. This, too, is lawlessness. Also, June begins Gay Pride Month, and there will be rallies and parades scheduled for every major city in America. This is lawlessness. Our country is $30 trillion in debt, and the interest on the debt exceeds what we pay for the military. And the Democrats are refusing to cut any government programs. This is economic lawlessness. And judges still continue to block the Trump administration's deportation of illegal immigrants. This is a coordinated effort by the Democrat Party to work with leftist judges to keep illegals in the country. This, too, is lawlessness. The culture war today is over the law of God. It all boils down to the law of God versus the laws of Satan. And the left hates Trump and conservatives because the Trump administration wants to maintain some semblance of the law of God. Last week, a Florida woman attacked a 72-year-old Trump supporter wearing a MAGA hat. Why? A woman was charged with a spitting in the face of Ed Martin, Trump's appointment to D.C. court. Why? An innocent couple working for the Israeli embassy was shot and killed by a Hamas supporter. Why? Well, because they hate those who represent and hold to the law of God. They despise accountability. They despise responsibility and God's morality. And this is why the nations are in a rage and the people devise a vain thing. Again, Psalm 119:126, "It is time for the Lord to act, for they have broken your law." We need in our nation a revival of God's law, because the gospel is going to fall on deaf ears if the law is not preached. People must know the law of God, be convicted by the law of God, have a respect and the desire to be obedient to the law of God before they'll ever come to Christ for forgiveness and for the power and the righteousness to keep the law of God. So let's remember that to change the culture, we must explain to people that there is a law of God to which the nation must submit to and to which the nation must acknowledge. The real issue is that people have rejected the law of God, God's authority, God himself. They have turned instead to man. Thanks for listening. May Jesus Christ reign.